Thank you, Paul, and thank you all for coming, and I want to thank Paul and this institution for the chair generally, which I do always think of as first Ann Coughlin's chair, because Ann had it when I arrived here and immediately before me, and as George Rutherglen's chair. And to me, that creates a lot of burden on the subsequent holders of this chair to try to live up to the initial holders of this chair. The talk I'm going to present today is based on a book manuscript that I largely completed last summer and fall, most of the time during which I was on research leave with my family in Munster, Germany. And so for that, I also need to thank Paul for his support for that research leave, and my wife Carolyn for making that daily productivity while on that research leave especially productive time, and maybe also for her indulgence. And when I brought my temperament home as the frustrations of this project varied from day to day. If she were here, I would thank my German colleague, Bettina Weissert, who provided just a tremendous resources and facility and was a terrific host to my visit there as well. So the good news for you is that I'm not going to present the entire manuscript. In fact, just a small piece of it. I'll give you some sense of what the larger project is about, but the focus is on the American system of criminal adjudication, sort of broadly conceived, meaning the processes by which we resolve criminal prosecutions, but also the institutions by which we initiate prosecutions and that shape the process from a definition of the enforcement agenda through the adjudication and resolution of cases, and to some degree on the terms in which those cases are resolved. And much of what I kind of set out to do, and especially what I'll emphasize today, is a kind of thematic account, a set of thematic reasons that I think of as descriptive, although sort of critical descriptive, with respect to the law and practice that defines adjudication, the doctrines, the rules, and the institutional choices that we make. And I think we can broadly describe our system as one that opts for rules and doctrines of a certain sort that follow these two themes, or so I will argue, of a preference for democracy, political process, political accountability on the one hand, and a process for oriented toward market-like mechanisms on the other. So later chapters of the book, just to kind of bracket what this leads to some extent, kind of looks at the implications and the consequences of these institutional choices. I develop an argument, for example, that the focus on efficiency and adjudication has served as a sort of subsidy to the state's enforcement capacity and effectively, eventually, its incarceration capacity. But I'm going to leave that implications and consequences piece of it aside and just focus on this sort of descriptive account. And much of the argument just aims to identify what the features that characterize and give some consistency and, I think, thematic unity to the adjudication system that we have. And again, it's sort of captured in this title of Democracy and Markets. And so by democracy, I don't mean anything especially fancy or peculiar, just the basic democratic political processes generally and political responsiveness in some manner to majoritarian views or popular sentiment, or at least of officials such as prosecutors to other elected politically accountable officials. And that it stands, political process does, and democratic process does, stands in some contrast to or as an alternative to law. So the more obvious examples of democratic institutions and adjudication, most obviously the election of prosecutors and judges, but also the political appointment of prosecutors and judges. And of course, the use of juries as a kind of emblematic democratic feature of common law systems. I don't pay any attention to the jury piece of it today. But all of these are mechanisms and choices that are, I think, democratic in some sense, or rely on political responsiveness in some sense, over more law-like alternatives, over rules that would select prosecutors through some merit-based process and protect them or insulate them from political influence with life tenure, like federal judges or civil service protections, or tenure, like we have. And by markets, I don't mean anything especially distinctive either, just the idea of the mechanisms that facilitate private interactions and private ordering in marketplaces and elsewhere that kind of stand as a rough contrast to public ordering or commanded control, publicly defined, rule-defined obligations and duties or definitions of outcomes. That's the alternative to sort of private ordering, market mechanisms, reliance on incentives and parties or individuals' free choice to follow their incentives and self-interest in both selecting the process or means by which they'll interact and the outcomes that they'll come to, either competitively or cooperatively. So examples of market mechanisms and adjudication, right? The most simple and straightforward example is just the adversarial system, especially if you stand in contrast to an inquisitorial system, right? The adversarial system just delegates to the parties the ultimate public task, the task that the public courts need done of generating the evidence and presenting the evidence to the court, right? And also effectively marshaling or invoking and arguing for application of relevant law. It puts the parties in competition. It gives them relative freedom to generate evidence and pursue their interests in this kind of competitive adversarial process, right? All this stands in contrast to at least a sort of model of an inquisitorial system. There aren't many true inquisitorial systems left anymore. They've adopted more and more adversarial features. But the contrast of the adversarial system that is still a significant feature of many systems today would, instead of relying on parties in competition pursuing their incentives to generate evidence and generating a full evidence record for the court by that party competition, you might have a state official, a judge, an investigating magistrate who has the obligation to put together a comprehensive evidentiary file and reach conclusions about the applicable law as well. So that's non-market-based, that's rule-based, rules creating obligations and public duties that stands in contrast to sort of the market idea or the competitive incentive-based idea of the adversarial system. So legal scholars are familiar with both of these ideas, of both democracy and political decision-making and that of market mechanisms or private ordering as alternatives to law in some sense, right? So you can contrast markets in a sort of free market paradigm with a highly regulated market where law would do a lot more work, talking about how parties can interact and what they can do and what the limitations are on their behavior and what the outcomes might be. And the same thing with respect to political process, right? Majorities might want to do things that are in conflict with the law's ends or the law's requirements. Law can be a contrast to a limitation on political process, and it can be a limitation on market behavior and market outcomes as well. So my argument is that these kind of two ways of doing things, or these two alternatives to a more law-like system, or a system that's more command and control, or more based on rules that define public duties and obligations and outcomes, are integrated into the American system of criminal law enforcement and adjudication to a much greater degree and sort of at a finer level of rule detail than we commonly recognize, I think, and that is true. It's true in the U.S. system to a greater degree than it is even in other common law systems, even in other systems with adversarial processes. So I think it's our traditions and our commitments related to both democratic politics and responsiveness and resistance to political insulation and legal regulation as an alternative to democratic accountability that manifests itself in the adjudication process. And the same thing with respect to our disposition toward market mechanisms, reliance on incentives and competition and free negotiation rather than law-like alternatives. So I'll give a few examples of those kind of rules and institutional choices that I think demonstrate the American system's special commitment to democratic politics over law and to market mechanisms over law. And I'll emphasize mostly today, I'll give you a few examples from largely from related to prosecutor, the law of prosecutors, you could say, the law that defines the prosecutor's institution and the prosecutor's power. So in addition to the more obvious feature, right, that we elect prosecutors and no other country in the world seems to do that, American prosecutors are distinct, I think, again, even in contrast to other common law nations, in their insulation from judicial supervision or review. Different way to put that is that courts have less power over what prosecutors do there's less, you could say, checks and balances between prosecutor and judicial power in the prosecutor's realm of authority than there is in other systems, which is a departure, which is a result of an evolution in the American adjudication tradition, because American courts started out with control over prosecutors. American prosecutors were, in many jurisdictions, a lot of variation in early state law and local practices. But American prosecutors, through roughly the mid-19th century in a lot of places, were often creatures of the court, were often appointed by the local judges in whose courtrooms they prosecuted, and were effectively under their control, and often in many state constitutions through at least the mid-19th century, and in a few states even later, in Louisiana even today, actually, the prosecutors were officially in the judicial branch of government rather than the executive branch of government. And so most of this changed in the 1840s and 50s, many more full-time prosecutor offices by this time, and in the same era when judges were moved in a wave of state constitutional reform to elected office, prosecutors were as well. And so I think it's this development, which you can think of as a development in the separation of powers, this kind of further separation of prosecutors from courts and the formal separation of prosecutors from the judicial branch and courts, that I think gives us a clue and has some explanatory power to the contemporary law that explains prosecutors' tremendous discretionary authority and courts' relative restraint or incapacity with respect to supervising that authority. So just to state some of the features of that relationship that are probably familiar, right, that prosecutors' charging discretion has very little basis in constitutional law or statutory law for courts to supervise. So there's just very little basis in either state constitutional law or federal constitutional law or in statutory law, the state or federal systems, by which courts can exercise the authority to double check or second guess or change or alter prosecutor charging decisions, including non-charging decisions. This is a contrast even with England, you know, perhaps our closest kind of common law adversarial system counterpart, in which courts still exercise the authority to review prosecutor charging discretions, really of all sorts, decisions to charge and decisions not to charge and decisions of what to charge, greater or lesser offenses, as well as who to charge. There's a range of standards by which they do this, and other common law nations do this too. Australia has a similar body of law. Civil law systems do too, but the comparison there is substantially different, right? So English courts use an abusive process standard to review prosecutor discretion and to sometimes overturn prosecutor charging decisions, a decision, a kind of basis you would never see, I think, in American law and American judicial review. It's overall a deferential standard of review, to be sure, and it doesn't come up as a matter of numbers especially often, but they especially scrutinize decisions where the circumstances raise suspicions about executive discretion, charging decisions with respect to deaths in state custody, for instance, where the prosecutor is considering charges on prison officials or police or the like. And they'll use prosecutors' own internal guidelines, the Code for the Crown, Code for Crown Prosecutors in England. They use the prosecutors' own internal guidelines for charging to double check whether charging decisions in a specific case fit those guidelines. Absolutely never occurs in the United States. The federal prosecutors have lots of detailed charging policies on their own. They're all explicitly, clearly not a valid basis for judicial review. Courts also, in England, also exercise just a general reasonableness standard when they don't have those sorts of specific guidelines and criteria to judge prosecutor decisions against. Again, something you just don't see in American law. So I think there's two related reasons that kind of explain this distinction, and I would say the American departure from what's still the common law tradition, as far as I can tell, in England and Australia and other common law nations. And one is just the trust in executive power, the greater trust in prosecutorial power specifically, that's developed along with, I think, American prosecutors' political accountability, right? It's the check on prosecutors in the U.S. through the political process rather than application of law and legal standards that does the work of supervising prosecutors. And so, in our view, there's just less need for that kind of regulation, in part because the political process does the supervision of prosecutors rather than law, law being applied by judges and exercised in a kind of judicial review capacity. The second reason, I think, is the doctrine of separation of powers has evolved along with this separation of prosecutors from courts in the 19th century and as federal separation of powers law developed more generally. This I haven't worked out so thoroughly, and there's not much about this in the current manuscript, but I think the separation of powers at the federal level has been especially influential on the state understandings of separation of powers and has filtered down to the court prosecutor discretion and regulation and authority relationship in a way that is not necessarily, is not required as a matter of federal constitutional law, but over time, at least with respect to prosecutors in courts and the adjudication system, the state constitutions have come to look a little more like the federal constitution, again, for instance, by putting prosecutors in the executive branch rather than the judicial branch. And the federal kind of separation of powers idea now seems to motivate the understanding of what court's capacity is with respect to prosecutor authority and prosecutor activity and kind of core prosecutor decision making. And so you see a lot more reference to prosecution charging decisions as an exclusively and especially executive branch function and something that's just not in the judicial competence. It's not judicial in nature in a way that courts have any competence being involved in. I think there's a second and maybe more puzzling feature, especially for my thesis. This is a second example of law and to some degree markets shaping the evolution and the current status of the law of prosecutors and the law of charging, you could say. And that's the status of victims, which you can think of as another rival to prosecutors or another possible check and institutional player as a balance to prosecutors. Following English practice well into the 19th century, into the second half of the 19th century, most American jurisdictions relied heavily on, typically victims, on private prosecutors to initiate prosecutions in different sorts of ways. Sometimes private victims, if a court finds probable cause for their complaint, can just hire their own attorney and prosecute. Sometimes the court would appoint a prosecutor upon approving a complaint. Sometimes the private victim's complaint would be forwarded to the district attorney and the public prosecutor would pursue it. Nearly all states now restrict private prosecution, and all states did so pretty substantially by the end of the 19th century. That's almost exclusively true today. There's one exception sort of in Pennsylvania where there's some authority for private prosecutors that seems never to be used. A couple of other state statutes that allow individuals to sort of initiate a complaint that the private prosecutor can review, and courts nominally have power to appoint a special prosecutor if the public prosecutor doesn't take it up. They seem never to be used. A couple of state exceptions, otherwise sort of complete abandonment of this private prosecution or variations of the model of victim involvement in the prosecution and charging initiation process. I think one explanation for that demise of victims as having a role in prosecutions, as well as the explanation for the retreat of judicial power over prosecutors, is again that we've assigned this task to these officials who've become both politically independent and politically accountable. And so we count on the political process and the democratic process to monitor prosecutors and to assure that the public prosecutors are using their monopoly over the charging power appropriately, such that we don't need a sort of competitive actor who could double check them by initiating prosecutions when they don't, and we don't need judges to second guess their judgments. Now, there's lots of other reasons to be suspicious of private prosecutors and actors who have disparate motives and uncertain motives and reasons not to give them the authority to invoke and gear up the state's criminal machinery. And so I think you would see a lot of that restricted anyway. You see it restricted in most other nations today anyway. But what you don't see is the complete abandonment of formal roles for victims in the prosecution process somehow. And I think it's important to recognize that the choice is not just simply a binary one of do you allow private prosecutions or do you allow public prosecutions, that there's different mechanisms for both regulating private prosecutors when they're allowed and for integrating victims as an actor other than a fully independent private prosecutor unsupervised by the public prosecutor. So England still authorizes private prosecutions. It seems not to be much used anymore, but the authority is still there. The Attorney General, the public prosecutors have the authority to take over the private prosecution if a private prosecutor proceeds, but the prosecutor still has, private citizens still have the authority to initiate private prosecutions. A lot of civil law countries have this kind of mechanism too. And what you see more often elsewhere is mechanisms that give victims participation rights in other ways. So Germany has reserved a set of relatively small, relatively minor crimes that only private parties can initiate, or at least only private parties can authorize the public prosecutor to pursue, right? That is, that the victims have a veto power over whether their victimization will be the basis of a public prosecution. So these are relatively minor offenses, but not completely minor, and they're in some sense substantial core offenses, minor bodily injury offenses, trespass offenses, property damage, invasion of privacy, some copyright offenses in the commercial realm. All those are examples in which private citizens or victims have some control over whether public prosecutors proceed with the prosecution. They also have authority to initiate those on their own, although there's a lot of safeguards that make it, I think, pretty unattractive as a prospect for an individual. You have to put up a bond to pay the defendant's expenses, litigation expenses, if the defendant fails, or if the defendant proceeds and the prosecution fails. And you have to go through mandatory mediation before it goes to the trial stage. So there's some both safeguards to private victim abuse as prosecutors, and it also limits the appeal of that process, I think. For more serious offenses, you see this a lot in Europe, in continental Europe. I don't think England has this mechanism, but there's mechanisms by which the aggrieved parties, either victims or victims' families in German and other European systems, can join the public prosecution process as a sort of auxiliary prosecutor or ancillary prosecutor and take a formal role. They can bring in their own attorney who will perhaps subpoena different witnesses, cross-examine or direct examine witnesses in different ways, make different sorts of arguments. And so that also is a sort of check on prosecutors, right, or a kind of institutional competitor to prosecutors' decision-making, and reduces their control over how cases proceed, at least, right? I think they're relatively minor restraints or infringements on prosecutors' authority in the grand scheme of things, because there aren't a lot of private prosecutions. And there seem to be more of these sort of ancillary prosecutors. Often they're pursuing kind of ancillary related civil claims rather than criminal claims, but sometimes they're pursuing the same civil prosecution with a sort of different strategy and maybe additional offenses added to the indictment. But American jurisdictions uniformly reject this, again, with the sort of the exception of Pennsylvania and a sort of nominal existence in a couple of other state codes. I think, again, the explanation for this absence of a check or an institution or a competitor to prosecution power and to this choice that affirms the public prosecutor's monopoly over charging discretion is the prosecutor's democratic legitimacy. That's not the only explanation, I think, and there's a separate avenue, a separate argument I pursue that I won't burden you with here, except just to sort of reference it, that I think the skepticism of government power that America is sort of famous for and is a broad theme in the way we structure government institutions clearly has some exceptions in a obvious and non-controversial way, and they tend to be in the security realm. Right, so we've become very comfortable with a large military establishment, despite our forefathers' skepticism of standing armies as being the military being one feature of government power that we were skeptical of. And the same thing, I think, with respect to the criminal enforcement power of the government. We're much more comfortable with that now than we were early on when we wanted the juries as a check on government power, because we're scared of government actors having too much power as criminal prosecutors and criminal jailers. There's been an evolution and a comfort in that kind of government power that I think helps explain the expanse of power that we get to give to executive branch actors, and especially in the prosecution context. So this is now called a Rubio. It's good enough for the next president. It's good enough for me. So I'll give you one more set of examples from a different kind of body of law, and another familiar example, what I think kind of jumps out as a market-based or market-inspired process rather than a legal regulation, kind of mandatory procedure process, which is plea bargaining. There's nothing distinctive about American plea bargaining just as a general form of non-trial settlement to reach criminal judgments and criminal convictions anymore. There once was. We were the earliest jurisdiction to embrace plea bargaining and embraced it most openly and most expansively. But there is something distinctive about the way that we regulate plea bargaining, or the rules by which we define plea bargaining practice, that I think makes it distinctively market-oriented and reflects that trust in market-like mechanisms rather than the more public-oriented regulatory systems that you see for plea bargaining and non-trial settlement in other jurisdictions. So here's a couple examples of that. One is the reduced role of the judge in the plea bargaining process, and even in the process of the judge accepting the bargain and issuing the court's own order of conviction. Judges have a distinctively minimal duty to confirm the factual basis of the plea, the factual basis for their own conviction order. There's still no statutory standard in most jurisdictions of the federal system. There's been a constitutional holding that you have to find a plea bargain valid and enter a judgment based on a plea bargain beyond a reasonable doubt, as is the standard in the trial process. So it's the judge's duty primarily in the plea bargaining process not to double-check the substance of the bargain and the substance of the court's order ultimately, right? There's no rule that says judges have to independently, or at least they're not is not as strong a commitment to this as in alternative systems. But the judge has a public obligation independently to assure the integrity and the accuracy and the validity of the judgment. Instead, the judge's primary duty is to assure that the guilty plea is knowing and voluntary on behalf of the defendant, which is a clue to how much the convictions are based on the negotiations of the parties and are products of the parties and the parties' negotiations, right? What the judge does is really make sure that the free market, so to speak, right, the private parties that are interacting and negotiating and consenting to a settlement resolution are doing so freely, right? And that there's no hindrance, as we define coercion, as we define duress, in that kind of free negotiation process, right? This is a distinctive choice, although it seems just second nature in the American system that we do this, despite our 50 plus different jurisdictions of American criminal justice systems. The uniform approach that the judge has this relatively minimal role with respect to the facts and the substance, and a primary role with respect to the consent, which is to say making sure that the negotiation is not coerced or duressed. The one jurisdiction that stands in contrast to that is our own military justice system, which stands as just an example of how the system could work differently and does work differently in that setting, and is fairly similar to how it works in some other common law countries, Commonwealth nations. So in the military justice system, the judges do have a much more vigorous obligation, a kind of central and mandatory obligation by both appellate courts, mandatory appellate review, as well as trial judges, to assure the factual and legal accuracy of the plea, even if defendant has completely consented to, and there's no question about the consent and the voluntary nature of the plea by the defendant. The judge has an independent obligation to put on the record the factual basis for the plea and the legal accuracy of the plea, meaning there's no defenses, for instance, that a defendant might have consented to when he was unaware of. Trial and appellate judges have to independently make that kind of substantive inquiry. It's called a providence inquiry in the military system. And it's a model of a less privatized, right, less market-like system that's more publicly regulated, right, and is structured more around public duties to affirm the substance of the outcome and public responsibilities for the outcome, rather than a kind of market-like exchange that generates the outcome. And so the second distinctive feature of plea bargaining, perhaps even more notorious, right, is that there's no regulation of the difference between post-sentence, post-trial sentences and plea bargain sentences, right? There's no regulation of the discount of the plea bargain off of what the trial sentence would be. So this is true as a matter of federal constitutional law. It also turns out to be effectively true, followed uniformly, as far as I know, by all the states as a matter of state constitutional law. And there's no effective regulation of that in state statutory regimes either. There's a couple of states that try to have statutes that in different ways try to limit the discounts, at least with respect to charging that prosecutors can offer off the initial indictment. They seem to be uniformly ignored or to have loopholes that legislatures are not interested in filling or closing. And so there's multiple grounds, right, by which we could imagine a regulation of that discount and understand it, for instance, as coercive and undue duress on the defendant, or we could understand it as suggesting an improper motive by the prosecutor because he doesn't think that both of these charge and sentence prospects that he's posing, one contingent on a plea, one in the wake of trial, can't think that both are appropriate for the same amount of conduct. If the distinction is so large, 5 years versus life in prison, that was the facts of the Bordenkercher v. Hayes decision, in which the court affirmed the absence of a federal constitutional limit to this kind of discount. We could say that any prosecutor who creates that kind of distinction, right, has an improper motive, or that there's a proportionality problem, or that that's undue duress. None of those doctrines have any traction in American federal constitutional law or in state law. I think it's the overwhelming consensus. Once again, the kind of contrast is striking with other nations where the law of plea bargaining is consistently different. And there is consistently plea bargaining in seemingly every advanced nation. Now, every nation that gets any study in Western Europe and in advanced countries in Asia. And so the old days of denying that there's plea bargaining in civil law countries like Germany is long past. Even the Germans don't deny it anymore. And England is another telling contrast as a system that you might expect would be as close to ours as any. England was much later in admitting that they were engaging in plea bargaining. They engaged in it much less extensively and seemed to have started it much later. And when the courts first intervened, as it happened the same year that the U.S. Supreme Court finally acknowledged and embraced plea bargaining in 1970, the English Court of Appeals was firmly against plea bargaining and forbade one of the core practices of plea bargaining, judges giving advance notice of what the trial sentence would be. But that didn't have much success of kind of hindering plea bargaining on the ground in England. And so the courts and Parliament stepped in with regulations that, most importantly, regulate the discount of the difference between the post-trial sentence and the plea bargain sentence. The discount is a maximum of 1/3, and it decreases according onto various factors depending on the timing and of when the plea is entered. There's also a separate body of doctrine that's never successfully overturned a plea bargain or found a plea bargain offer invalid, but there is a doctrine by the House of Lords decision from several years ago that holds that a plea bargain discount can, in theory, be so great that it constitutes coercive pressure. Now, the plea bargain discounts are no longer so great that the English courts are going to be presented with them as English cases, right? This comes up in a case in which the defendant is in England and is being extradited to the U.S. and is facing a plea bargain choice or opportunity there that the courts are examining as a precursor to figuring out whether he's going to be sent to a system where he would be unduly coerced as English law defines it. So there's just a stronger regulation or a stronger set of rules with respect to substantive fairness. and a stronger set of public norms and public commands, regulation of the market, you can say, right, with respect to this bargaining process that the parties engage in to reach the foundation on which courts enter convictions, enter public judgments. So I think here, too, you see the influence of kind of market ideas in criminal adjudication, and that helps explain the distinctive path that American law takes compared to any other nations in these respects, but I think the closest comparison are to other common law nations. And I'll just say, note as a final example of the same sort of deregulation and reliance on the parties as adversaries rather than prosecutors and judges as public actors with public commitments. The rules that kind of define components of the so-called minister of justice norm, right, with respect to prosecutors. All systems, including the U.S., define prosecutors, at least aspirationally, as ministers of justice, as having a special commitment to fairness and to proper outcomes, independent of mere partisan advantage and partisan desire for victory in litigation. That's defined in sort of aspirational ethics norms, and it's also defined in kind of specific obligations of prosecutors. Here again, you find the American rules are consistently weaker than counterparts in England and elsewhere. Again, they're much stronger and different in the civil law systems like Germany to the degree it's just sort of an apple and oranges comparison and not an appropriate or fair comparison probably. But in other common law systems, we already have prosecutors who are in a relatively non-political institutional structure, right, and insulated from political influence of both the elected public officials, much less kind of direct democratic accountability. They already have that kind of institutional protection that instills a sort of ministerial, neutral, we might say bureaucratic kind of norm, rather than a partisan adversarial norm to their role. England mandates much more rigorous kind of pre-trial disclosure of evidence by prosecutors, things sort of Brady disclosure obligations of exculpatory evidence and the like. Those sorts of obligations are much more expansive in English law and Australian law than they are in American law. There's no duty in American law for prosecutors to seek out evidence, right, favorable to defendants, as opposed to disclosing the evidence. There is some disclosure rules, right, that are weaker than English rules and more readily waivable than English rules. But there's no obligation to seek out evidence, right? It's a disclosure obligation for when you have evidence that favors the defendant. Nor is there a professional or cultural norm, for the most part, right, that puts a strong emphasis on sort of investigating both sides of the case, right? It's not the adversarial prosecutor's role as a matter of norm and custom, and I think reality, to think of themselves as having a duty to fully investigate the defense side of the case or put together an objective full record of the case, as opposed to sort of making sure that you have a strong enough case that you are convinced you have the right person for the right charges, but not that you're doing the sort of work that we allocate to the defense side, right? And that we think of the other side of the adversary system, the other partisan having to take on as their role in the process. So American rules minimize this kind of robust minister of justice norm in some specific legal rule obligations, I think, as well as in the institutional structure by which we create prosecutors' offices. It makes the adversarial system and the adversarial role of the prosecutor more adversarial. In that sense, it makes it more free market-like because it's more competitive and parties' activities and roles and decisions are incentivized by their role-based self-interest as partisans and advocates on one side of the adversarial process. And it makes it less regulated market, right? It's less rule-based and regulated and more governed by the incentives and the interests of the parties, the prosecutors, their interests as defined by their role as the executive branch advocate in the process, right? So I think, again, here, too, a big part of the explanation is the reliance on political supervision of prosecutors rather than the legal regulation, and on the trust in the market-based system that's a little more sharply designed and defined by American legal rules in the adversarial process, rather than a system that's more mitigated and mediated and regulated by public duties and public rules and public obligations by either judges or prosecutors. In that sense, it's more adversarial and competitive and market-based, less kind of defined by public interest and public obligations. So those are some of the examples of the kind of rules and institutions of our criminal justice system that, in my view, are greatly influenced by these two kind of themes that make, I think, the American political tradition and history, and the American political economy specifically, both more democratically oriented and more market-based, right? So in the kind of comparative political economy literature, we're famous for being a so-called small state or weak state at the federal level. Comparative political economists have spent a lot of time and energy sort of figuring out and explaining in what sense we're a weak state and distrust government authority and public institutional power and favor these kind of democratic mechanisms over the power of the central state. Right? And we're a more market-based economy rather than a more corporate economy or social democratic, more regulated economy like you see in Europe and Asia and elsewhere. And I think this broad political economy and historical themes and commitments filter into the logic and the explanation that makes us choose these particular forms of the American adversarial system, the American adjudication system, in a way that ultimately has a range of implications I won't pursue here, but I think in part it makes us think of the outcomes of the criminal justice process, thinks of even the substance of convictions, as more a product of private action for which courts have relatively less responsibility than they might otherwise. And so in a range of default rules and waiver rules that can affect the accuracy of judgments and the content of sentences and judicial outcomes of adversarial process, you see mechanisms by which the responsibility and the fault are put on the parties and the punishment for the parties in not pursuing their fulfilling their incentives in their adversarial or partisan roles is to lose the case. Either prosecutors lose the case, defendants lose the case and get punished. The adversarial roles generate their incentives, and the consequence has to be, in some part, that they take responsibility for a verdict, for the judgment, for the outcome and the sentence, even though these are public acts and public decisions and the kind of core state action in as a form of ultimately defining, restraining liberty of convicted individuals in a way that courts don't have to take as much responsibility for, and the state more broadly doesn't take as much responsibility for, because we in some sense privatize it and think of parties as legitimately bearing some responsibility for losing the case and for the inaccuracy or the integrity of the verdict and the judgment because of their own default or their own choices and their own power in the process. And so with that, I'll stop, and I'm happy to take some questions or...